So you're all done listening to your Gopher hockey. What's going to keep you going now? Well, maybe we should talk about some sex. How about that? How about that to get your attention here on Closing Argument? My name is Walter Hudson. You're listening to Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream the program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in and remaining tuned in as we come out of your Gophers hockey programming. Brad Omland produces the show, tends to take your calls here on the program. Yeah, so, you know, sex has been in the news quite a bit. Allegations of sexual misconduct. We talked about it pretty extensively last night during our Thanksgiving show, and kind of the broader cultural meanings that we could derive from what's taking place right now in the media. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to offer a perspective or ask questions or delve a little bit deeper than you typically are going to find in your mainstream media sources. I'm trying to get to the root of the problem, the root of the issue here. And there's a story here out of the Star Tribune, which I think stands as a pretty good catalyst for a conversation about deeper problems in our culture. And let me define what I mean by our. Okay, because, you know, that's one of those words that can be very general or very specific. In this case, I'm using it with some specificity in terms of what I'm talking about. When I talk about our culture in this instance, in the instance of this story that we're about to go over here, I'm talking about the listeners to this station. I'm talking about us, myself included. The culture of, you know, Midwest American, a typically Christian-identifying individuals who espouse a certain morality, right? From the Star Tribune, a teacher charged in April with third-degree criminal sexual conduct will stand trial next week in Sibley County Court. Megan Jo Johnson, 40, is accused of having sex with a 17-year-old boy who came to the private school where she worked. He sought help after his father abandoned him. According to court documents, Johnson went to the Sibley County Sheriff's Office in March and reported that she had an inappropriate sexual relationship with the teen. She was a kindergarten teacher at Prairie Lutheran School in Gibbon, Minnesota, and an active member of the school-affiliated Emmanuel Lutheran Church. Her trial starts Tuesday. In 2015, the boy showed up at the school seeking help. He was from Guatemala, and his father had recently left him. He knew little English. Johnson, who speaks Spanish, acted as his translator and tutor. Johnson told authorities she assisted him with immigration paperwork and provided food and clothing. She helped him enroll in school and become a member of the church. Johnson told authorities their sexual relationship began in January of 2016 when they were driving back from a family law attorney's office. The relationship escalated during their tutoring sessions, and before his Bible study, they would have sexual encounters inside the classroom, at her home when her husband was gone, and sometimes at his newly adopted home. I'm going to read that again, because I want this to sink in of just how perverse this is. Their relationship escalated during their tutoring sessions, and before his Bible study, they would have sexual encounters inside the classroom, at her home when her husband was gone, and sometimes at his newly adopted home. This is insane. Continuing at the Star Tribune, Megan stated that she knew what she was doing was wrong, according to the criminal complaint. The victim confirmed to authorities that Johnson, or what Johnson had reported. However, he told authorities that she was the aggressor and that he was afraid, confused, and did not know what was happening, according to the criminal complaint. The victim, now 18, said Johnson became emotional and upset when he was adopted by another family. Johnson told authorities she felt like a mother toward him, which, of course, makes this even crazier. Johnson's defense attorney argued that the state lacks evidence to prove she was ever in a prison, or I'm sorry, in a position. I'm a little bit of a Freudian slip there. I'm expecting that she's going to end up in prison. Johnson's defense attorney argued that she lacks evidence to prove she was ever in a position of authority over him and that she was not his primary teacher. The defense asked the judge to dismiss the complaint. Prosecutors argued that Johnson was in a position of authority. The judge denied the request for dismissal. Now, I share this story not to, you know, lament about the general, you know, I did that yesterday, lamenting about the general culture of sex that we have adopted in these modern times, where we're willing to tolerate much and then are shocked when things go too far. And then, you know, we decide that we're offended, but we're not actually willing to scale back the culture to actually rein things in and provide some sort of social deterrent to this sort of behavior. But the specific utility of this story for me is the religious aspect, because we're dealing with a situation right now. And I know, listen, I'm a Christian, right? I'm a member of a church community. I don't mean to imply at all that this is the norm, that what this lady did is somehow indicative of where we're at as a Christian community. But what I am suggesting is that there is something missing, obviously, from her judgment. There's a disconnect. The fact that she could, adjacent to, tangential to a Bible study, engage in an illicit affair, which, you know, arguably was statutory rape, with a younger boy. You know, she's 40, he's 17. The fact that she was capable of doing that indicates a clear disconnect between her espoused religiosity and her actual actions, her actual choices, right? Now, obviously, that's true of her. You know, I don't think you're going to find too many people who dispute that about her and this incident. Now, here's where we're going to get controversial. Here's where I'm going to challenge you a little bit. This is also true, that disconnect also exists politically when we talk about, specifically, Roy Moore. Now, Roy Moore is accused of acting in much the same way as this gal did. Now, granted, we're talking about 40 years ago, and he denies it. You know, those are crucial differences which must be cited in order to be intellectually honest here, right? But nonetheless, there's a variety of accusations. They come together to form a credible narrative. If the burden of proof was merely the preponderance of evidence, you know, like in a civil trial, then you would be able to say it looks pretty bad for Roy Moore, right? And, you know, at issue isn't even, that's the, you know, you hear folks like Hannity and whatnot talk about how, and more than one person has said it, not just Hannity, that, you know, a person is innocent until they're proven guilty. Yeah, that's true in a court of law. It's not true in terms of our own judgment of whether or not we ought to associate with someone, whether or not we ought to elect someone or support someone or vote for someone. And we are proceeding in this particular moment in history as conservatives and as Republicans, and, you know, this is the more general we, because I know there are some exceptions to this rule, but we are getting behind and supporting a guy in the name of politics, in the name of fighting the left and beating the Democrats, who is, by the preponderance of evidence, as guilty as this Johnson character is. That, to me, indicates a disconnect between our espoused religiosity, our espoused morality, and the actions that we are choosing to take. Now, you know, if that's not true, then I require somebody to explain it to me. This is Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I know it's dangerous territory when the host of a conservative talk radio show starts directing his criticism towards his audience, right? Like, that's inherently risky behavior, but I'm willing to take the risk because, well, quite frankly, I think you can handle it. I think that's the thing. This audience, you know, conservatives generally, you know, we are thinking folks. We are mature. We have the ability to confront those things. We're not afraid of criticism because we have the resources with which to process those criticisms and determine whether or not they're legitimate or illegitimate and then act accordingly. And I have faith in your ability to do so. And, you know, I'm right here in the boat with you, right? Like, I include myself in this critique that I'm offering here today on the program on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. So I talked about this, or I shared this story from the Star Tribune about a kindergarten teacher who is about to go on trial for having engaged in a illicit sexual relationship that at the very least was adultery, right? Like that, you know, that's not a crime in this state, but at the very least it was adultery with a 17-year-old immigrant student from Guatemala who came to her school, to her church looking for help, and she provided it, and the relationship grew into something that it should not have become. Now, what she's on trial for, of course, is statutory rape, if I'm understanding the story correctly, because he was 17 and she was 40, and also because she was in a arguably in a position of authority over him, being as that she was, you know, one, a teacher, a figure that she was coming, that he was coming to in need, you know, seeking service, right? And also that she had kind of embedded herself in his life as a surrogate mother figure. And so, you know, the argument is, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the trial, but the argument is that she was in a position of power, she was in a position of authority, and she was abusing that authority and therefore guilty of sexual misconduct. I cite that story in order to provoke a conversation about the evangelical culture that we find ourselves in today. You know, and this is something that, you know, whether or not you identify as an evangelical Christian or not, I think it's a conversation that's worth entertaining. You know, obviously you're going to be coming at it from, there are going to be different stakes for you personally, depending upon whether or not you identify as an evangelical Christian yourself. I do. I know there are others who don't, but regardless, from either perspective, I think there's value here in considering this question of what does that even mean today? What does being an evangelical Christian mean? And, you know, it's a question that has emerged out of our current political moment because we have all of these allegations of sexual misconduct that have emerged in recent days and weeks. And amongst them, one of the most prominent allegations or set of series of allegations have involved Senate candidate Roy Moore in Alabama. And he's become a lightning rod or a figurehead or however it is you want to phrase it for how we collectively deal with this topic of sexual misconduct within the context of the Christian evangelical community. Because what you see happening, and you know, this is by no means universal. There's not like one evangelical position on Roy Moore, right? You know, it's a diverse community. It's not monolithic. There are people across the spectrum, both politically and in a variety of cultural ways, and certainly on the question of Roy Moore, people who support him and people who don't. Be that as it may, there's a notable portion of the evangelical community, particularly in Alabama, who have come around Roy Moore in defense of him and in support of him. And the question that I'm asking is, how do you do that? And to me, it's a similar question to how does this kindergarten teacher, in the context of her church slash school, where this kid comes to her for help, and in the context, because a lot of this activity, according to the story, a lot of the illicit relationship, the sexual encounters, took place in the context of Bible studies. How do you go from here to there, right? Like, how do those two things connect? How do you, in the context of a Bible study where you're supposed to be reflecting upon the Word of God and a higher standard of morality, do you go from that to I'm going to cheat on my husband with a 17-year-old kid in that context? It's mind-boggling that she was able to do that and with apparently no sense of shame, or certainly if she did have a sense of shame, it didn't rise to the level of preventing her from taking further action on multiple occasions. Okay. So that's her problem as an individual. And what I'm suggesting is that what she did as an individual is mirrored or echoed to some degree in how collectively much of the evangelical community has reacted to Roy Moore. There's a piece over the New York Times. Caitlin Scheiss has a sterling evangelical pedigree. She grew up in evangelical churches in Colorado and Virginia and graduated from Liberty University before entering Dallas Theological Seminary last year to prepare for a career in the church. But lately, she has been frustrated by evangelicals' failure to challenge the prejudice and predation in their midst. Over the course of the week, as Roy Moore, the Republican senatorial candidate in Alabama, faced more allegations of inappropriate sexual conduct with young women and teenagers, many evangelicals leapt to his defense. To Ms. Scheiss, this is one more sign that a new ritual has superseded Sunday worship, the weeknight Bible, and weeknight Bible studies, a profane devotional practice with immense power to shape evangelicals' beliefs. This liturgy is the nightly consumption of conservative cable news. And, you know, the article goes on. You know, this is the New York Times we're talking about, so of course they have a strong liberal bent, and they go on to demonize Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and Fox News and what have you. Now, here's the thing. You know, like as conservatives, we need to be able to separate the baby from the bathwater here. Much of this article is bathwater. You know, going into how horrible Fox News is and how horrible Sean Hannity is and how horrible, you know, Tucker Carlson is and what have you. But there is a baby within this bathwater here. And that is the question of how do you support a guy like Roy Moore, given the preponderance of evidence that has been provided of his sexual misconduct? And, you know, not just sexual misconduct in the nature of, you know, cheating on his wife or, you know, whatever the case may be. We're talking about potentially engaging in the molestation of teenage girls. Okay? That's kind of a big deal. And in the context of the church, in the context of evangelical Christianity, how do you stand by that? Look, I serve on the elder board of the church that I attend. And one of the questions that's raised when you're considered for that role is whether or not, I'm trying to think of the exact biblical way that it's phrased, but it's beyond reproach. That's the phrase. Thank you, God, for putting it in my head. Beyond reproach. That's one of the qualifications, that you ought to be beyond reproach morally, which means that's a very high standard. Okay. Now, I'm not saying this to toot my own horn by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I am a sinner just like anybody else. All right. But what that phrase means is, what it implies is not that you're not a sinner or that you don't do anything wrong or that you haven't in the past ever done anything wrong. What beyond reproach means in a practical sense is that you have a reputation that is unblemished, right? At least to the extent of, not, you know, and, you know, again, we're not talking about some sort of highfalutin, holier than thou standard. What we're saying is that you have, let's put it this way, you haven't been accused of molesting children, all right? That's the standard, okay? That's one of the standards. You haven't been accused of molesting children. Like, if you were being considered to become an elder in any given evangelical Christian congregation, and you had been accused, not proven in a court of law, right, but accused by multiple people of having molested kids, you're going to be disqualified if the congregation is sane. If the congregation is proceeding under a biblical mandate, you are going to be disqualified for that position of authority, okay? So my question is, if that's the case, and it probably ought to be the case, how is it that you're going to turn around and elect that same person to be a U.S. senator from your state? A question worth asking. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You know, I remember last year, 2016, during the election, when these questions, you know, because right now we find ourselves in an environment where allegations of sexual misconduct are prolific. They're coming from everywhere. You know, people are coming out of the woodwork and accusing this person and that person and the other person of having engaged in various forms of sexual misconduct. And, you know, this is a thing now. This is something that we're living through, something that we're apparently going to experience for an indefinite period of time moving forward. And the concern and the fretting and the hand-wringing over it is something that seems relatively new, because it was just a year ago, just a little over a year ago, that the candidate for president of the United States, Donald Trump, was likewise saddled with a variety of sexual misconduct allegations, and it did not matter at all. Now, to be totally fair, which I strive to be, you know, whether I succeed in being so or not all the time, to be totally fair, the allegations against Donald Trump were different than many of the allegations that have been forwarded against various people recently. In that, you know, if you were using that preponderance of evidence standard, you know, where you're saying, look, you know, things need to be corroborated, you need to look at the totality of what's being said, who's saying it, and, you know, whether or not there is supporting circumstance to substantiate what it is that they're claiming. The preponderance of evidence did not exist for the claims that were made against Donald Trump, at least the ones that I'm immediately aware of or recall, right? Whereas when you look at somebody like Roy Moore, for example, or Al Franken, you know, let's be bipartisan about it. The preponderance of evidence does exist that suggests that there is some, if not total, truth to the accusations that have been leveled against these men. So that's a distinction that properly ought to be made. Nevertheless, for the sake of this discussion that we're having here tonight on Closing Argument with me, Walter Hudson, on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, we can recall that last year when these allegations against President Trump were made, that the argument from many folks, many conservatives, many Republicans was, while none of that matters, right? Specifically, let's talk about what was Access Hollywood, that tape. When that tape came out, because that wasn't an allegation, that was tape, right? Like the guy was caught on tape saying things that if they were said in your place of business or your school or your church, you would kick the guy out, right? Right? I mean, I would hope so. That's the standard that we set for these places that we commune in our own lives on a day-to-day basis. You would kick somebody out for talking like that. This tape came out, and the argument from the very same people who would kick a random Joe out of their place of business or their church or whatever for talking the same way, the case was made that, well, it doesn't matter because, and this was the phrase, we're not electing a pastor. We're not electing a preacher, which was true, right? Like, we weren't electing a pastor. We weren't electing a preacher, but what I find interesting about that particular form of argument is, first of all, it's a straw man, right? Like, literally nobody was arguing that we were electing a spiritual leader to run the country. That's not something that anybody was arguing. So by reiterating that we're not doing that, you haven't actually addressed the real point, the real elephant that's in the room. But the implication is that the qualifications to be a pastor, the qualifications to be a spiritual leader, have nothing whatsoever in common with the qualifications to run the country, to be the chief executive of the federal government of the United States. Now, you know, I would argue, I would agree with you if your argument is that it's not a apples to apples comparison. Certainly the two jobs are different jobs. That said, some of the qualifications do cross over, do they not, right? Like, shouldn't there be some standard? Now, I'm not saying it's the same standard, but shouldn't there be some standard of character, some basic, minimal moral sense or moral quality that a man or woman ought to have in order to hold any public office, let alone the highest public office on the face of the planet? I would like to think the answer to that question is yes, but in practice, obviously, the answer is no. No, we do not have that standard. And, you know, I think that is not something that goes without consequence. It's not. And look, this is not an anti-Trump rant. You know, this what I'm talking about here, what I'm observing here, really has very little to do with Trump. It has everything to do with the rest of us. It has to do with our culture. And again, you know, culture as Americans, sure. But I'm talking about, you know, those of us here in this proverbial room right now. You know, the conservatives, people who identify as Christians, people who identify as Republicans, people who identify on the right. Our culture. We have decided that character does not matter. We have decided that moral quality is something that we're not going to seek for in our candidates. That we are going to accept the Roy Moores of the world into positions of authority that when we would never ever, like if you were hiring somebody, like for something minor, like a plumber to come in and unclog your drain, if you were going to hire somebody and it came to light that they had been accused by multiple people of molesting teenagers, you would not hire them, right? Even though, in that case, what you were, the occupation, the job that needed to be done, would not necessarily be adversely affected by them having molested teenagers, but you just don't want to associate with that person. You don't want them in your home. You don't want to have that, you don't want to be anywhere near them or have anything to do with them, right? Properly. Yet we've developed, and I don't understand it. I do not, for the life of me, understand this disconnect that has developed, particularly within the minds and the hearts of conservatives, this disconnect between that good sense of I don't want to be associated with that in my micro life, in my day-to-day life, but I'm totally fine with voting for it. I'm totally fine with it being the person that's going to be the standard bearer of my party. I'm totally fine with it being somebody who's going to represent me in the U.S. Senate. Right? I'm totally fine with electing them to governor or whatever the case may be. It's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me that this is the case. Now, let me draw a distinction here because I think this is important. And it just occurred to me that, you know, there's a potential here for this to be misunderstood and misapplied to me in particular in the future. I don't mean to suggest that if a candidate for office, for instance, has ever done anything untoward, you know, engaged in any sort of inappropriate conduct, that should disqualify them necessarily for public office. Well, who was the guy who was running for mayor of Minneapolis this last time around? Ray Dean. Raymond Dean is a former felon, convicted, served time, right? And yet, he was a member of the state legislature, and he was running for mayor of Minneapolis. Now I totally disagree with Ray Dean on almost every point of politics, but in terms of his background of being a former felon, I don't think that should necessarily disqualify him for public office. And the reason why is he has changed. He has reformed. He is repentant. He understands what he did. He's paid for his crimes. He has reformed. He has repented. He has turned his life around. Now, he's still totally wrong on politics, totally wrong on ideology, and not somebody who I would ever vote for. But my reason for not voting for him would have nothing whatsoever to do with his former criminal past, because he is reformed. In a similar sense, somebody who has done something, you know, let's say sexual in nature, in the past, depending on what it was, you know, I mean, there's certain things that you know, you can't get past, but depending upon what it was, shouldn't necessarily be disqualified from running for office just because that happened. It depends on their attitude towards it. And let's go back to the question of Donald Trump. When that Access Hollywood tape came out, and, you know, the various allegations of sexual misconduct came out in 2016, if his approach to the whole thing had been, you know, that was me from a different time. I've changed. I've found Jesus. You know, I've found religion. I'm devoted to my wife now. I regret having acted that way. Like, if that had been his approach, if he had been regretful, if he had been repentant, then I would totally be down with the idea of, hey, you know, we're going to give this guy a chance because he is repentant, right? But that wasn't the case. Neither, by the way, was it that didn't happen. That's not real. That tape's been doctored. That wasn't his argument either of I'm not guilty. His argument was, that's who I am. Get over it. This is me. I'm moving forward anyway, and I'm going to make America great again. And our collective reaction as conservatives, as Republicans, was, yeah, I'm down with that. Now, that blows my mind. It blows my mind. And similar now with Ray Moore, this willingness to just adopt the guy, in spite of the fact that not only was he accused of doing these things that are reprehensible, but he apparently doesn't care that he did, right? And again, you know, you have to these aren't apples to apples comparisons because you have to sort through the differences. He's denying the fact that these accusations are true, and what have you. But again, looking at the preponderance of evidence, it's pretty clear that something happened, and it's pretty clear that it was untoward. So the fact that he's unrepentant, that concerns me. But it doesn't concern a lot of other folks. And I don't understand why. I don't understand why it is that we've developed this sense where personal loyalty to a person or a brand, whether it's somebody like Donald Trump or Roy Moore or the Republican Party generally, has completely displaced any sense of personal honor or moral character or moral expectation or moral quality in us. It's troublesome. From the Star Tribune, Wisconsin Senate candidate Kevin Nicholson, a consultant for Fortune 500 companies, doesn't look much like the renegade outsiders whom political strategist Steve Bannon says he's recruiting for his war on the Republican establishment. But Nicholson has Bannon's backing anyway, thanks to his loyalty to President Donald Trump. As Bannon drafts his team of challengers to the old guard, the new guard is increasingly aligned not by ideology, but by its history of support for the president. Republicans who have criticized the president or been slow to embrace him are out. Well, I guess that includes me. I guess I'm out after, you know, years of advocacy and action and activity and support of the Republican Party and conservative causes and the Tea Party and what have you. All of that means nothing because Donald Trump showed up 5 minutes ago and said some things that made people clap. I'm stunned. I'm stunned. I don't get this. I don't get how this is where we're at, how this is what we've become. We'll continue when we return. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream this program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on the podcasts by going to your iHeartRadio app and searching for Closing Argument. Our channel will pop up, and you can catch up on all the programs that we have ever produced. We are transparent here at Closing Argument on Twin Cities News Talk. Appreciate you guys tuning in. So we've been talking about, I don't even know how to phrase it. I don't even know how to paraphrase it in a nice little, neat little package. The Steve Bannonization of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. You know, Bannonization, it doesn't really flow off the tongue, but that's basically what I'm talking about. The Steve Bannon effect that is taking place here. You know, I think calling it Trumpism is ineffective for a couple of reasons. One thing is that it ties it to Trump. And, you know, people, whenever you evoke Donald Trump, people's brains shut down for good or ill, right? Like on one side or the other. Like if you're against Trump, your brain shuts down with all the things that you don't like about Trump. And if you're for Trump, your brain shuts down because you're sick and tired of hearing people complain about Trump, right? So, you know, tying it to Trump is ineffective in that sense, but I also think it's ineffective because it limits our consideration to Donald Trump, when in actuality, the problem that I'm trying to open our minds to here tonight goes way beyond Donald Trump. It really, honestly, at the end of the day, has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It doesn't. It's not him. He is not the problem, okay? He's a manifestation. He is a symptom, I guess. He's there. And he's the most visible example of what it is that I'm trying to talk about here tonight. But he's not the center of it. He's not the source. You know, when you get rid of Trump, you're not going to end this problem. We had this issue during the Obama years where a lot of folks, particularly within the Tea Party, of which I was a part, became unhealthily, if that's even a word, had developed an unhealthy fixation upon the person of Barack Obama. And it got to the point where it's where the birtherism thing manifests from and what have you. This focus on we got to get Obama. And if we just get Obama, if we get him out somehow, if we magically conjure some mechanism by which we can oust him or impeach him, whatever the case may be, then all our problems are going to be solved. Which was a strategy that didn't acknowledge a couple of things. One, you get rid of Barack Obama, you get Biden, right? Like, because Biden was the vice president. So that, there you go. You've exchanged one leftist for another leftist. The problem has not been solved. And two, Barack Obama was elected. He was elected. So there are people out there in this country who thought Obama was a good idea. That's your problem, not the person of Barack Obama, okay? And so in a similar sense, when we examine what's taking place right now with the current state of the Republican Party, the current state of the conservative movement, and President Donald Trump, it is a trap that I admit, I confess to having fallen into myself, of developing an unhealthy fixation with the person of Donald Trump at the exclusion of dealing with the actual broader systemic cultural things that have manifest into Donald Trump. And that's what I'm challenging us with here tonight. Going back to the Star Tribune. As Bannon drafts his team of challengers to the old guard, the new guard is increasingly aligned not by ideology, but by its history of support for the president, Donald Trump. Republicans who have criticized the president or been slow to embrace him are out. One particular test for the Breitbart News chairman and former Trump White House strategist is how such Republicans reacted during the campaign to the 2005 Access Hollywood video showing Trump bragging about sexually imposing himself on women. Those who kept quiet about it or stuck with him earn Bannon's favor now, even if it means looking the other way on some policy positions and affiliations. Nicholson, for example, this is a guy, Kevin Nicholson, who's running for Senate in Wisconsin, has backing from wealthy free trade advocates, an awkward policy fit with Trump's economic nationalism. If you were never Trump, refused to ever endorse the president or withdrew your endorsement following Access Hollywood weekend, don't ever bother walking through Bannon's door, said Bannon advisor Andy Surabin. Bannon hopes chiefly to topple Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, whom he has blamed for obstructing Trump's agenda, especially efforts to dismantle Barack Obama's 2010 health care law. Bannon has threatened to find a Republican primary opponent for almost every GOP senator seeking re-election in 2018. Now, there are a couple of aspects to this. This Bannonism, this Bannon effect, or whatever it is you want to call it, that I don't know. Maybe I'm dumb. Maybe I'm not smart enough that I don't understand what the rationalization or justification is for this. There are a couple aspects to this that I find puzzling. One is, what in God's name is the point of loyalty to a man? I don't understand this. I don't understand this at all, one bit, for a second. What is the point of loyalty to Donald Trump? Like, what this article indicates, and this is news to me, is I actually find it quite fascinating. What this article indicates is that Steve Bannon doesn't even care if you're with him on policy. Like, he doesn't even care if you're with him on his protectionist economic stuff, all the national populism that supposedly lies at the root of this movement, this Trump movement that has given us our current moment in political history. He doesn't even care if you're on board with that. All he cares about when he's deciding whether or not to support you or oppose you politically is whether or not you've been loyal to Donald Trump personally through thick and thin. And the litmus test that he uses is the Access Hollywood tape, which I agree with him is a pretty good litmus test. If you were on board with Trump after Access Hollywood, you didn't think that was a big deal, then yeah, I guess that's a pretty good indication that you're a loyalist to the man at the exclusion of any sort of principle, right? But I don't understand the purpose of that. Like, what does that do for Steve Bannon? What does that do for anybody at all other than Donald Trump? And if the whole point is just to affirm and affect and support Donald Trump, the man, why? What does that do for you? How does that change your life? How does that change Steve Bannon's life? I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me. The other aspect of this that I find puzzling, and you know, it's less puzzling than just I think it's ill-conceived, is this strategy that Bannon is taking, that he's going to find a primary opponent for almost every GOP senator seeking re-election in 2018. Now, we've talked about this on the program before, and it is indicative of what is called, I'm reaching for the term at the moment that I need it most, confrontational politics. That's what it is. Confrontational politics. You know, there's two schools of thought, broadly speaking, regarding how to engage in political efforts. One is this access base, which is the more common, you might say, establishment way of doing things, whereby you engage in fundraising and lobbying and invest money and organize in order to support candidates, in order to gain access to them and have influence over them once they are elected, right? There's that method. The alternative is confrontational politics. And that's where, instead of support in order to gain access, you wield threats in order to compel action. And the threat is, we're going to run against you. We're going to vote you out. We're going to primary you. Now, confrontational politics works very, very well in specific circumstances. It works with issues where there's a broad base of support and you have a large constituency that's organized and willing to vote on a single issue. So something like guns or abortion. These are issues that are, it's very effective to engage in confrontational politics and to threaten to primary people, because you actually have the ability to conjure the votes. It's not effective, historically, it's not effective when you're basically saying, anybody we don't like, we're going to primary. Which is basically what Bannon is doing. He's saying, we're going to run primaries against everybody in 2018 because we don't like them. Now, the test here, and it'll be interesting to see how this pans out, the test here is, has Donald Trump become an issue unto himself on the par with something like guns or abortion, whereby the support for Donald Trump and the loyalty to Donald Trump is so strong that you actually can organize a successful confrontational politics campaign based upon loyalty to Donald Trump alone? That's what we're about to find out, and it will be fascinating to witness in 2018. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Appreciate you guys tuning in. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can catch us each and every weeknight. Appreciate you joining us, listening in. Catch up on the podcast in your iHeartRadio app, where you can also stream us live. You can also stream us over at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Brad Omlin producing the show this evening. I want to share a anecdote with you guys. You know, as I've mentioned a number of times on the program before, I serve on city council out in the northwest portion of the Twin Cities metro area, the bleeding edge of the metro area, which is fascinating. It's interesting to be part of a community that is right on the edge of things, where the transition from like the Met Council governed empire of the core here, the suburban core, that's, we're just outside of that. We're in Albertville. That's the city where I hail from. And I grew up in Cottage Grove, which is kind of a similar community on the opposite end of the metro area. When my parents bought their house in Cottage Grove way back in the day, 1992, I believe it was, when you looked out the front window of our house, you saw the subdivision. You saw Cottage Grove. When you looked out the back window, farmland. We were literally on the bleeding edge of civilization, at least as defined by suburbia, right? And, you know, there's something compelling about that. I loved it. I loved growing up in that environment where, you know, I could hop on my bike and, you know, I could be in the heart of a suburb, or I could be out in the country within 10 minutes. If we got in a car, you know, we could be, you know, to the Mall of America in 20. We could be to downtown St. Paul in 20. You know, I could be to downtown Minneapolis in 30. You know, we were within arm's reach of every different kind of environment. I really liked that growing up that way. And in a similar sense, that's where Albertville's at right now, where, you know, they are, we're right on the cusp of expanding, of the sprawl, of the urban sprawl, the dreaded urban sprawl. And so, at any rate, I wanted to share a anecdote with you guys. I don't often talk about city business, the stuff that we do on city council here on the program, for a variety of reasons, one of which is the fact that I'm legally barred from doing so in some cases. We have this thing called the open meetings law, where in a business that's being considered before the council properly ought to be discussed within the confines of a publicly noticed meeting. And if you have a quorum of your council that is meeting outside of those confines, that can very quickly and become a violation of state law. And so in order to avoid even the appearance of that, I don't often talk about city business here on the program, because you never know who's listening, including potentially a quorum of my council. It's a very conservative interpretation of the law, but I like to be conservative here on the program. But what I'm about to talk about with you kind of goes beyond, or doesn't really fall into that particular purview, because this isn't an issue that we are considering so much as an issue that we've been presented with by the state legislature that I think is indicative of a trend. And that is the move of cellular companies towards something called small cellular. Now, you may not have heard of this, because I hadn't prior to it being brought before us as a city. But apparently, the next generation of cellular technology, you know, right now you got your 4G and your 3G. Apparently, once you get to 5G, 6G, or whatever, however many Gs we're going to end up eventually getting to, it requires a totally different cellular infrastructure. And part of what it requires is this equipment that is lower to the ground and more prolifically distributed around the community. And so what they need is they need to be able to actually put up antennas on the street, essentially, throughout subdivisions. And so it's going to look a lot more like, say, your telephone pole or your power cable. It's going to be much more prolific, is what they want to do. Now, they've run into issues trying to do this because they don't have the same access to right-of-way that those other public utilities have. And so what the cellular company did, if I'm understanding it correctly, is they went to the state legislature and they lobbied, because they'd been going around to different cities and asking for permission to place their antennas in various areas, very rights of way and what have you. And they were being denied because the communities didn't want what they regarded to be an eyesore placed throughout their residential subdivisions. So, you know, not to be deterred, the cellular companies went to the legislature and they lobbied them and they said, listen, you know, this is something that is going to benefit. This is the future. This is going to benefit your constituents. We need to have increased cellular load. This is something that needs to happen. So we're asking you to pass a law that effectively mandates us to be able to go in and place our antennas wherever we want to in these rights of way throughout the cities of Minnesota. That law passed. It passed. And so now they get to do this. And, you know, one of the things that has been under consideration within our city council and city councils everywhere, probably close to you, whether or not we are going to, or to what extent we're going to regulate the placement of these small cellular antennas the right of way in our city. And at any rate, you know, the details of that aren't particularly compelling. The reason I bring it up is because I predict that this is the start of this whole development of the cellular companies having to go to the legislature and say, please, you know, mandate that the cities let us place our antennas in these rights of way. This is a step towards making cellular service another utility, just like the phone company used to be, just like, you know, cable effectively is, with the many exclusions that you have. You know, you can't just pick from whatever cable company in the nation that you want, and you are barred based upon which one has been approved for your area and what have you. This is the conversion of what has been up to now a relatively free market to basically the formation of another public utility, which I do not think is going to speak well of the quality and the options that are available to us moving forward. And again, you know, this has nothing whatsoever to do with the policy that we are considering at the city level, because at the city level, we have no control over this. This is all the state. And listen, I think the thing worth exploring here is that this is not the, I don't believe that this is the intention of either the cellular companies or the state legislature at this point. I don't think they want to become a new public utility. What I think is happening is that they are unwittingly teeing themselves up to become a public utility, because they see the profit in having these antennas in the rights of way throughout the state. And so they go to the legislature in order to get the access mandated. But then here's the deal. Here's the second edge of the sword. Once they get in there, and once they're dependent upon being located on a right of way that's been mandated by the state, at that point, the state has them by the short hairs. At that point, the state can decide on what conditions they are going to allow access for these small cellular towers. And that is all they need in order to begin mandating and regulating and controlling every single aspect of how the cellular companies are run. And at that point, you basically have provided the mechanism by which you have a wonderful new public utility. Not something that I am looking forward to at all. And, you know, probably not something that the cellular companies are intending or looking forward to, but it's the consequence. And that's really my point in sharing the story, is that it's a cautionary tale. Be careful what you wish for. When you go to government to try to solve your problem, you got to think long term about, and you got to think incrementally. You know, what is this logically going to tee up in terms of the next step that can potentially be taken? And is that actually what I want? Is that actually in my long term best interest, something that we seem increasingly incapable of considering nowadays? Long term versus short term best interest. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Appreciate you tuning in. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Always fun to have you with us. There's a piece over here at the Star Tribune. It's a commentary that I find interesting. The disappearing blessing of speaking face to face. When the machines are in control, we do and say things we would never say in person. This is something we've talked about here on the program before. The author, I'm not sure if this is a gentleman or a lady. You never know with a name like Chris Potter, writes, in the reams of paper ephemera at my house are buried postcards sent in the early 1900s from farm relatives who lived near Medalia, Minnesota. They read thus, stopped by to see you, you weren't home. Where were you? We'll try again next month when we go to town again. Imagine a world of interpersonal communication where it took a month to get an answer. Where you sent a postcard, which likely took a week to arrive, to let someone know you had stopped by. Postcards were big then. Some of mine are leather with burned-in designs sporting catchy phrases such as, how would you like to hold my hand in Minneapolis? A human hand holding a hand of cards is drawn neatly by the type. This communication took effort. It likely led to many misunderstandings or delayed responses to timely concerns. But today, our answers are too quick and moderated by machines. I sometimes begin a conversation with someone based on information I got about them on social media. I know something about them they never told me directly. They sometimes look startled, but then relieved when I explain the origin of the knowledge. I only know because they told a machine, and then the machine told me. Communication today becomes a road rally. Think of bad news, the race that families face to deliver bad news of illness or death before it gets out on social media. The human need is to convey such information person to person, to hear the gasp and offer the words of consolation. The deepest news demands that we face each other. I watch people pushing children in strollers, phones in hand. I think back a couple of decades to stroller rides I gave that involved constant communication with the person in the stroller. Look at the leaves. Did you see the doggy? Do you want a snack? Let's go fast. Let's get out. Sit down. I love you. A patter of words with gurgles and coos as response, but I've read that we now need to teach children to treat home assistant devices with respect. Children should not be allowed to yell at them as it might lead them to yell at real people. It's a chilly communication that is moderated by a machine. Then there was a time I attempted to use the smartphone as a natural consequence, telling my teen that due to some infraction now forgotten, the cell phone would be in my possession for a full day. The look on his face revealed all I needed to know. I had gone too far. The punishment didn't fit the crime. I realized then that the phone was part of the relationship. It was woven into that teen web of friendships, and it was simply a bad idea to interfere with that all-important teen support system. I also noticed the speed that teen plans based on cell phone speed would morph and shape shift until I had no idea where the kids were and what they were doing. So the rule of let me know when you are changing location was put in place at our house. The parental scrambling we did in those early days of the ascendancy of the phone. The frantic speed of communication by machine, the words are out before we have filtered them or looked someone in the eye to see how our words are affecting them. The speed bypasses empathy, circumvents the natural consequences of the fall of the human face, and enables us to rage, rant, hurt with no thought at all. The push of a flat, non-clicky key is like a silent ambush. We creep out onto the airy platform and strike. The digital playground spats would be amusing until I think kids are watching this. Teens are absorbing this. Adults are engaging in this. Leaders are leading us where? We eagerly lap up the words of all-out anger, set free by technology that even now is shaping us. Now, this is something, you know, there's a lot in here that is worth our consideration in this commentary here at the Star Tribune. But it's this last thing that's evoked, the example that we're setting, that I find most compelling. You know, when I was growing up, which was not that long ago, when I was growing up, there was this sense that you had as a child and as a teenager that the adult world, that adults generally were on a higher level than we were, right? Like that they had that there was higher standards, that there was a higher degree of comportment, of expectation in terms of behavior. There was this concept of maturity and acting in a mature fashion that meant something. Now, granted, and you know, I think this is true. That was an illusion. Like my sense that I had, and I don't know if you know my peers at the time shared that sense that adults were on a different level than we were. But that was an illusion, right? Like in reality, adults are every bit as, you know, fickle and misbehaving and maladjusted as teenagers are, but they insulated. There was this certain degree of insulation between, you know, you learn as part of your maturation process, you learn to filter yourself, right? Like you might still think the things that you shouldn't say, and you might still say them when you're in the bar or when you're with your friends in a insulated environment. But there's some degree of insulation between the more base, immature things that go through your mind or that come out of your mouth and the rest of the world. That is no longer the case. We now live in a world through social media, through the advent of, you know, our electronic interconnection, whereby there's this main line, this direct connection between people's innermost thoughts and their most base instinctive reactions to things. Those are all transmitted now. They are broadcast to the entire world, which includes children, teenagers and children. Our children are seeing our arguments over, you know, Donald Trump and Roy Moore and Bill Clinton and, you know, whatever else the case may be, whatever cultural thing is happening right now. Our children are seeing the comment sections, you know, laced with profanity and personal attacks and what have you. There is no illusion. There's no longer any insulation between adult misbehavior, adult misconduct, and the eyes and ears and minds of impressionable young kids. Now, that is going to have an effect upon our culture that has not fully manifest yet, because this is the first generation. You know, keep in mind, Facebook is just over 10 years old. It's been around for a decade. We have yet to see what a generation that has grown up on social media looks like as adults. We don't know what that looks like yet. I mean, I hate to sound like an old fogey, but I am terrified. I am terrified of what that looks like. What do kids who have grown up, not just with the ability to transmit their own thoughts instantaneously and, you know, growing up with screens in front of them all the time, but kids who have had no structured, let's put it this way. They haven't had reality metered out to them, right? Like, you can be overprotective as a parent, in my opinion, where you try too hard to insulate your kids from the real world.
Broadcasting on AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 100.3 HD2, and worldwide on iHeartRadio. This is the Twin Cities News Talk Station, KTLK AM, Minneapolis.